Good morning. Open to Paul's epistle to the Romans, chapter 1, please. I began a couple of sessions ago, going over some aspects of the gospel. Now, we understand the gospel, and so did the people in Rome. When Paul writes these chapters to the church in Rome, he's not writing them because he thinks they become deficient in the gospel, as if they've forgotten what the gospel is. This is one of the most detailed and interesting aspects of the gospel printed in the Bible, because it approaches various questions regarding humanity. When missionaries go out to the world, or we go to our neighbors, we go with a biblical understanding that all people everywhere have fallen short of God's glory and are considered in the scriptures to be sinners. But there are problems with that because there are objections people make. The gospel began in Jerusalem in the Middle East. It is not really a European invention, isn't it? And it began in the Middle East and it began to spread. And Paul started from the church in Antioch in Syria and began to move into Asia, and he began to move into all parts of Europe. And he was in Corinth at the time he wrote this, and he wrote to the church in Rome. He had never been there to visit them, and he said, I want to come and visit you. I want to help you understand the gospel more, not because you're deficient, but because from Rome the gospel would move into Europe. It would go to England. It would go to other places. And he wanted the people to understand that when they went into a world to give the gospel to people, regardless of their culture or their language, regardless of the fact that they were sophisticated or people that Paul calls in chapter 1 so far as to call them barbarians, who were considered people who were not civilized as some of the other Gentiles, that all of these people had the same needs before a holy God. And he asks and answers various questions. For example, what is the gospel? Well, in the introduction to this book that ends at chapter 17, the introduction to it, he has told us some things about the gospel. And he has said that it's the power of God to salvation, verse 16, that the issue is to everyone who believes in this. It begins with the Jew first, simply because Christ was a Jew and born in Jerusalem. And it moves out from there. To everyone who believes, to the Jew first and the Greek, for in it the gospel is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith. The gospel is a revelation. It reveals something about the person of God. And it reveals something about his character. It reveals something about his person. It reveals something about what God desires. So in the gospel, God is revealing, he's unfolding things. This word reveal is actually the same word that is used for the book of Revelation, the apocalypse. It's an unfolding. And in the gospel is the unfolding of certain things about the character of God and how God can be righteous, and yet he can, by faith, allow unrighteous people to be made right with him. And it's something that Paul wanted them to think through, because they were going to take the gospel outside of Rome to other places. And they were going to have to know that the world needs the gospel. And so in the gospel is the righteousness of God revealed. But the next question would be, but why do people need this message? Why do they need the gospel? And he will begin in chapter 1, verse 18, and he will go to chapter 3, verse 20, and he will begin to explain the condition of the world. Now, he will begin very, very simply. He's going to talk very simply about the people who are outside of Judaism, the people who do not have the revelation of God written in the law, but he's going to go beyond that, and he's going to go very simply to tribal people, people elsewhere, who know nothing of our God. And he's going to say they have a need. And the reason they have a need is because, believe it or not, they are guilty before a holy God. So he's going to begin to prove, first of all, that the Gentiles are guilty. Now, by Gentiles, we're just going to say, at this point, keep it simple. They're everybody who's not, at this time, a Jew. Whether they're sophisticated philosophers or they are what Paul calls a barbarian, they are not people who were not born under the religion of the Jews. Then in chapter 2, he's going to prove that religious people are also guilty. Their guilt will be held against them because they have some revelation from God in the law and they have failed to keep that. And he will prove that these people also need the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then ultimately, as you know, what he will prove when you get to the end of Romans chapter 3, verse 23, he will simply say this, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. This whole portion is trying to prove why, how all have sinned, how have they sinned, and why are they guilty, and how the gospel meets their needs. And I don't expect this to be academic. This isn't some course taught in a Bible school. This, to me, is very clear. We're going to hear things from people today in our culture. We're going to hear people say, why take the gospel out to the people? Leave them alone. They have their own religion. They have their own consciences. And Paul's going to answer that question. And how can a loving God condemn and show judgment to these people when they have never heard the gospel? Are people guilty if they've never heard the gospel? And the answer will be yes. And why? So this isn't supposed to be a Bible school course. It is supposed to be informative so that when we hear something from the people around us, we may understand what the scriptures say. So this is important. Now verse 18, Paul begins the main body of the book of Romans. The main body. And he says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Now just as the righteousness of God is revealed, he says the wrath of God is revealed, and it's the same word. Not only in English, but it's the same word. Apocalypse, unfolding, unveiling, like Revelation. All right, so he is saying, not only in the gospel do we see the righteousness of God revealed, his character. Now we also see something, that the wrath of God is being revealed also. The judgment of God. And so this is kind of important, for the wrath of God is being revealed, and it means it is already being revealed. It means at this time, in some way in human history, God has been showing something about his anger towards sin. And I'll define these words. His anger towards sin, and it's an ongoing wrath that is taking place. And this is, I think, important for us to understand, because God is already in the process of judging mankind. Here's how I'm going to outline it. Paul's going to demonstrate three things. All right, we'll outline it this way. Verses 18 to 20, he's going to demonstrate the revelation of the wrath of God, that God has a right to show the world how he stands regarding sin, and he has a right to judge people. All people, not just religious hypocrites, but all people. Verses 21 to 23, we'll talk about the reasons for the wrath. And then in verses 24 to 32, the results. So first of all, the revelation of the wrath of God, and then the reasons for the wrath of God. How could he judge people who have never heard the gospel? And then the results of it. What has happened in human history that results in God's continuing judgment of people? Here's the two main features. I'll give you the two main features from verses chapter 118 to 320. The two main features are simply this. The Gentiles, because they rejected God's general revelation in nature, are guilty. And the Jews, because they acted contrary to specific revelation, are guilty. Now what's the point of this? If he's not writing the Church of Rome to correct them, what's the point? If believers do not believe that people everywhere including themselves, deserve God's wrath, there's no motivation to take the gospel out to the world. There's no motivation to take the gospel to our neighbors, or as Paul's case, he said, I'm going to visit you, that I may encourage you, that you can encourage me, and I'm going to move on to Spain. Now, we don't know if Paul ever got to Spain, but one wonders if he was even seen beyond Spain. So unless we understand that people everywhere, including ourselves, are guilty, and we deserve God's wrath, there's really no motivation to take the gospel out. We're not taking the gospel out because we want to spread Western civilization. Now, I realize that that happened. But the bottom line has always been, that people need the gospel and need to be saved. Let's do some definition of terms. The word wrath, all right? We've seen here that the word wrath is revealed from heaven. And one of the things we know about God is he can't change. In the gospel, the righteousness is made known. There's a standard that God has in himself. And that God doesn't change. He is altogether righteous. He is altogether right in his character. Therefore, the fact that he's altogether righteous, he has a right to judge, and his judgment will be based according to his own character and not according to our view and our whims of looking at things. So he says the wrath of God is revealed. And in the original language, the tense means it's constantly being revealed. There's a constant revelation of it. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're way ahead of me. But isn't the wrath of God at the end? Of course, it is. At the end, the period of the end of the human history, where God will judge, and he will come in to judge, and there will be a wrath of God against humanity. There certainly is at the end times. But what Paul is saying, and remember, Paul was a philosopher as well as a Pharisee. What Paul is saying is that God in human history has been showing his displeasure for sin. And one day, he will come at the end time and judge. But meanwhile, in a continual way, the wrath of God is going on. From Adam, when Adam and Eve fell, and the ground was cursed. And after this, before the flood and the creation, we can see God in human history dealing with people. Now, let's go over these words. There's one word in the original language, the Greek, where the word wrath means a sudden outburst, a troubled emotion, a blow-up. And just blowing up and getting angry. That's not the word that is chosen here. He chooses a word that James also chooses, where he says, the unrighteousness of man does not work the wrath of God. What he's saying, pardon me, the wrath of man, his total rebellion, does not work righteousness. The word simply means it is something less sudden. It is something lasting, but something that takes place. Okay, so this is the idea of this wrath. It is a present, continuing idea. Now, I'm going to read some verses from the Psalms. You can write the verses down, but I'm going to move rather quickly. The psalmist says in Psalm 7:11, God is a judge and is angry with wicked every day. If he does not turn back, he will sharpen his sword. He bends his bow to make it ready. But God is a judge. He is angry with the wicked every day. Now, we have to understand what this means. God is looking at creation and man, and there's a certain sense where he sees out of not glorifying him, not following him, and this long present anger would be like, a parent who sees their child in continual problem. There's a sense of anger about this, not a blow up, but a sense of anger. It must be dealt with. A sense of frustration that comes into it. All right. And in human history is the history of the judgment of God. So this is where Paul is going to begin. It is, as he says in chapter 2:5 of Romans, he says there's a treasuring up of for yourself wrath against the day of judgment. Now, there's where he talks wrath in the final day. There's a final day of judgment. and that final day will take place, and you are storing up wrath. Meanwhile, during this period of time, there's judgment. Now, here's reactions. I'm going to give you reactions and questions as I go over this, and I hope that you'll follow, because I don't always make myself clear. You're intelligent. I don't always give it the best way. But here are some reactions. But isn't anger wrong? Isn't anger wrong? We hear this. Among men, anger is considered ethically wrong. And today we even have in schools anger therapy. We have anger therapy for people. Those boys who shot up the school in Colorado had been going to anger therapy. Boy, they really were cured, weren't they? They took guns and went out and killed. But they've been going to anger therapy. We see anger as ethically wrong. Yet among us, we talk about righteous anger. And when we send somebody before a jury, and the jury concludes that this person has broken the law, we consider that just. You must see this. Book of Romans is a courtroom scene. When you read chapter 1, you almost feel like you're having an attorney, the prosecuting attorney, reading something in a court of law, bringing out certain things. So the word says anger is wrong. Well, wrath is a manifest part of God's righteousness, and it's evident to us that there's something wrong, something out of our unrighteousness. What the wrath means then is that it is a part of God's righteousness. It manifests His righteousness, and it's evidence of our unrighteousness. And that's what verse 18 says, godliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and righteousness. Now, wrath comes as a result of judgment. And judgment comes as a result of comparing to a standard. That's why the jury convicts this person. Compared to a standard, they are found wrong. So this is the idea behind the wrath. It comes as a result of judgment, and judgment comes as a result of comparison with a standard. Now, we often feel today judgment is wrong. You hear it all the time. 6-8 weeks ago, I'm watching one of the news program stations. Something happened somewhere, and they were interviewing a teenage girl, the way they always interview people, quickly if something happens. And this girl said, it was tragedy, and I know they did wrong, and they shouldn't have. And then she excused herself and said, but I wouldn't want to judge anybody. Well, I'm thinking, tell it. Judge them. They were stupid. They did wrong. See, but she backtracked. I wouldn't judge. She's taught that any form of judgment is wrong. And so we hold your standards to yourself. Don't judge. Who are you to judge? So this is the way we feel. We feel judgment is wrong because, well, we do make mistakes, and that's true. We do make mistakes. And we don't have all the facts, but we also feel judgment shows prejudice and intolerance. And we must accept everything is true. But you see, here God is righteous. And a righteous God has a standard. And He is not corruptible. He's a righteous God, and He is demonstrating His anger. Not blow up, but His anger toward human beings in human history. So, wrath comes against all unrighteousness of men. Now notice this, all unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and righteousness. Now here's the next question. Well, wait a minute, it comes against all unrighteousness, but what about the innocent people in Africa or the jungles? Well, you don't call them jungles, then rainforest, okay. Rainforest. In the rainforest, see, and I've lived in the rainforests. And when it rains, they aren't so pretty. To tell you the truth, it's hot and humid and buggy. Anyway, the rainforests. And what about these innocent people in Africa's jungles who have never had a chance to hear the gospel? Is God unfair to judge them? Remember, He said His wrath comes against all ungodliness. So the next question somebody brings up. Now remember, these are things that Paul is suggesting to the Romans. They were contemporary to the Romans, and they're contemporary to us. And they've never heard the gospel. Is God unfair to judge them? How can He judge someone who hasn't heard the gospel? Let me make a statement. And you have to follow my statement very clearly, because I don't want to be labeled a heretic in this thing. Just follow it. and just fought it week after week. Romans, the book of Romans says nothing about the wrath of God coming upon those who do not believe the gospel. They are already guilty. See, they are already guilty. If it means that people are only guilty after I preach a gospel, then my sense is don't take the gospel out and make them guilty. Stay home and do your work. And don't tell people, because then you're sending them. The book of Romans doesn't say that the wrath of God is coming upon those who do not believe the gospel. They are sinners. No one has ever, who has ever heard of Jesus Christ, will ever be judged for not believing. Person who's never heard. They will be judged, according to Romans, because God has revealed things to them, and they've gone against this, and God sees them as sinners. This is so important to taking the gospel to the jungles or to our neighbors. Because people will come up with this and they will bring this up to us. Say, well, what about those who have never heard? In the innocence of their conscience. Chapter 2 deals with conscience. One of the things I must say as I move on is that Paul is studying very simply. Don't get complicated. He's studying very simply. And then the next chapter, he gets a little bit more complicated, a little deeper. In other words, what Paul is doing is just laying a very simple foundation. And upon that truth, he builds another. And upon that, he builds another. He's beginning with the basics. All human beings have received a revelation from God and have known that there is righteous and a just God. And they have gone against that, and they are guilty. Now, this is the bottom line. Now, notice verse 18, what he says. He explains verses 19 and 21, the condition. But he says they suppress the truth. Now, in the original language, it means to hold the truth down. And it gives the idea not only do they do this verbally, but they do it in their conduct. In other words, God has been moving and revealing himself to people in ways, and we keep suppressing it, pushing it aside, pushing it aside, pushing it aside. The suppression of truth is the problem. People are guilty. God had revealed himself, and mankind continually represses the truth. He replaces God with other things, and God will hold him accountable. So this is where we get the idea of sinners. Now there is what we call general revelation. And I wouldn't ask you to study theology books, but if you went to some Bible school or you'd study theology proper and you would study cause and effect and you would study natural revelation and how much God had revealed himself, it's just part of your general theology course. It's kind of fascinating. The reason I thought it was is because when I was with the tribal people in Colombia, had I had a greater knowledge of this, or greater intellect, I was fascinated by what these people knew. And yet they had never heard the gospel. They had not been in contact much with Western civilization. But I was fascinated by this aspect of natural revelation. I told you one morning that the one Indian village I was in, I got up, and I was having a hard time sleeping because they go to bed when it gets dark and they get up when the sun comes up, and I want to go to bed at 11 o'clock after the evening news and wake up. Anyway, I woke up one morning and the men were leaving the village with machetes. Now, I thought they were going out to the gardens, but usually the women work the gardens and the men sit around and fish. So they're all, where are you going? We're going out to kill somebody. What do you do? What do you do? Now, they said something. They have no written word. They don't have a language written down. They have nothing to read. They said, he did something wrong. And I said to the capitan of the village, how do you know he did something wrong? How do you know it's wrong? It's wrong. Murdering is wrong. Other things are wrong. I have no idea, by the way, I can't finish the story. I have no idea if they caught the guy, if they hacked him up with the machetes or what. I have no idea. I missed the ending, so I don't have much of a missionary story here. I missed the ending. But I said to the capitan, how do you know it's wrong? Oh, it's wrong, you know. No, I don't know, Señor. No, yo no sé. Explíqueme, tell me. I was trying to draw him out. So, there's general revelation. Now, let's look at this. Because. Now, notice the word because. All right? The wrath of God is against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth. How did they suppress the truth? Because is an important word in my New King James, but yours may say for this reason. Because what may be known of God was manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. We are not brute beasts. We are not animals. And God created us in His image. And there are some Christians who actually believe people who aren't redeemed don't have the image of God in them. That's nonsense. The image of God is in everybody. Doesn't mean they're saved, but it's in everybody. We're not brute beasts. Therefore, I kind of stand against the people who, because animals suffer and feel pain, they try to put animals on the level of human beings. Or because animals can be made to sit, roll over, bark, and jump, that they're on the level of human beings. They're not. What is this that he's revealed? Well, he reveals, let's look at this. What may be gone of God is revealed, for God has shown it to him. He's shown it to us because we're intelligent beings. And as intelligent beings, and this is what philosophy talked about, philosophy and mythology looked at the world and drew some conclusions called cause and effect. So it's intelligence. Let's over here in Psalm 19, 1 and 2. And usually I don't hear the person when they read the scriptures. But this morning when he said, the heaven declared the glory of God, my head went right up. Because this is important. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day into day, utter His speech. And night into night reveals knowledge. There's no speech, no language, where His voice is not heard. The heavens declare the glory of God. And day by day, God was revealing Himself. His character, His person. So, the idea here then is that we take because what may be known of God. And then he says this, for since the creation of the world, this is important. See, Paul, is as a philosopher and a Pharisee, is going back and looking at human history. People say this, human history began with rudimentary things, and then people believed in spirit. Then they began to develop the concept of God. Then they began to develop the concept of one God. Then they began to develop this. And man has been going up, evolving over the years to a concept of one God, loving, kind, saving. Well, Paul is going to go back to human history and say, it's just the opposite. Mankind's been going downhill. Now, we don't believe that because of our modern invention, but our modern inventions aside, he said mankind's been going downhill. It's our modern inventions that make us feel, because we're so intelligent, I'm so happy that they have new procedures for health. But that makes us feel then that we are capable of understanding the depth of God through human knowledge. Well, Apostle Paul says, no, God has been revealing Himself. So this belief is what we call intuitive and universal. It means in them they know, and it's universal. Everybody has it. When you talk to the natives, the Indians, who haven't had the gospel or know anything, and you can't just get into ramifications of theology, you can ask them a simple question. You can mention something, the word conscience, and even though they don't have it quite, they understand. They'll say, there's a la voz, there's a voice inside. A voice, yeah, see, see. Abaces, that voice tells you. No. They get it. Has anybody here ever obeyed everything the voice has said? But they know. And so, this is the thing. It is intuitive. It is universal. Every effect has a cause. There's an order in the universe. And this order in the universe is interesting. There's another one in the Psalm. 94:9. He who planted the ear, shall he not hear? He will form the eye, shall he not see? He who instructs the nation, shall he not correct? He who teaches man knowledge, the Lord knows the thoughts of men and the futile. This is the cause and effect. Understand, you senseless among the people, and you fools, when will you be wise? He who plant the ear, shall he not hear cause and effect? I see all of this intricate design, and human beings in the jungle and others have concluded that there's some designer. Now, mind you, they don't know who this designer is, and we have to tell them. But they believe very clearly that there's something bigger than them, more powerful than them, grander than them, something more intelligent than them. And so this is an important point. All right, so the Apostle Paul says, for creation, since the creation world, his invisible attributes clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so they're without excuse. You have eyes. Don't you know somebody who created you have eyes? They understand. Why is it when we go, let's say, the mountains of Colorado, Estes Park, or somewhere, and why does nature really gives us an emotional, positive sense of awe? Does this just come because we're just emotional beings, or because we are made in the image of God? We see the wonder, the grandeur of it. As I drove through the Andes Mountains in Colombia, I was always in awe of this thing of design and power and order. I love working in the mountains. Working in the jungle, no matter what they say about the rainforest, it's the pits. But driving the mountains, the cool mountains, and enjoying this grandeur. But your emotions are into it. This is what Paul is saying. All right. So here's what they've done. One, the gospel then is to go out to the whole world. Now, here's a question people may raise. Why give the gospel if people already know about God through natural creation? In other words, somebody might say, see, they always have their religion. They already know about God through natural creation, so let them follow God at that level. They're only responsible to follow God at that level. And the Apostle Paul would say, can't do it. They can't do it. In other words, what some of the arguments are saying, simply they just have knowledge, whether it's simple knowledge or complicated knowledge, they have knowledge, and everybody is just responsible for that bit of knowledge. And this is an idea. Well, Paul has said in verse 18, they suppressed the truth, and in verse 23, he said they substituted the truth and changed the glory of incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. So he says this, they suppressed the truth and they had to substitute God with somebody else, something else, man-made. But let's look at verse 21, because verse 21 is really important. He gives the reason for God's anger that God has a right to show. Verse 21, because, catch that word because again, leads us to the next point, because, though they knew God, now their knowledge of God was simple, but they knew God. And what happened? They did not glorify him as God. In other words, they knew God, but decided even the knowledge they had of God was not worth retaining and living for and holding up as a standard. They knew God. They did not worship and glorify him as God. And the next thing that happened, nor were they thankful, which is logical. If I don't think God exists, and if I think I owe nothing to him, I'd be thankful. Right? There's a movie called Shenandoah. I like old movies. Jimmy Stewart. He's caught in the middle of the Civil War. He's got a family, a farm, and he's worked hard, and he decided, I'll stay neutral. But the war comes in. You can't stay neutral. It comes in, and pretty soon a child is killed, and his wife and a son gets picked up by accident and taken off to a prison camp in Andersonville and the whole thing. And much of his life falls apart. At the end, when it's all over and the family's there, but it's been broken up by war. Jimmy Stewart bows his head to pray the way he did every time, but this time he keeps his eyes open. He said, "We thank you, Lord, for what we have because we did it ourselves. We built it with our own hands." And he gets up and walks away from the table. Now, that's an interesting part in the movie, because he's become hard. Tragedy brought hardness, and hardness against God. So I said, "We did it ourselves. We're retired over the years." And he walks away. See, not thankful. It's a very interesting part of this movie. Shows what the war and the tragedy did to his heart. And so he can't thank God. So he says this, "They did not glorify him as God, so why be thankful?" And then verse 21 also says, "Nor were thankful, but became futile or empty in their thoughts." In other words, what happened is they knew God, they didn't glorify him as God, they weren't thankful, so their thinking became pointless. They had no starting point in their lives. Their thinking became pointless. It's all me, myself, and I. How will I make it? See? When they moved away from God, suppressing the truth, then he says in verse 21, very simply, but became futile in their thoughts. Their thinking was pointless. There's no starting point in life. The starting point is simply me and what I can get and how I can enjoy. And it's what I get for myself. There's no starting point. And then, of course, the last part of verse 21 says, "And their foolish hearts were darkened." Now, it didn't say their intellect was darkened. Their hearts were darkened. The inner man where light comes. But their intellect, of course. People invent wonderful things, right? I mean, the medical procedures and beautiful Mercedes with cataclyptic convertibles or whatever it's my hearing. I don't know how to hear those. That's all good inventions. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about here. And this is what happened to people, isn't it? The hardness. They lost their point. They lost their center. They lost a reference point in life. And having lost a reference point in life, the heart became dark. When God is declared absent in human thoughts, humans lose much more than they bargain for. Truth and absolutes are quickly abandoned. And human beings that don't understand this. This is where the wrath of God comes in on a continued basis. We lose more than we bargain for. And humanity has been losing. So here's the downward spiral. They rejected God. They made up old ideas of what God should be like. Verse 25. They fell into sin. And then God gave them over. And it said they became fools. Verse 23. So they substituted. Exchanged. They substituted. Biblical times, if you were driving your chariot through the countryside with stereo, two guys on each side singing, and you were driving your chariot through the countryside, you would see on every hill idols. The God of fertility, the God of crops, the God of travel, the God of war, the God of advantage over my neighbor. They'd be all over the place. Idols. Well, we don't have those anymore, so we feel pretty proud, but while they may have made idols in the shape of animals and beasts and people, we may make an idol of a person. Do we get our morals from Oompa every day on TV? What's her name? It's my hearing again. I don't hear well. Do we get our morals every day from Oompa? Whatever. It's my hearing. Get back here. Where do we get them from? So we make people. So we look back at the idols and say, "Oh, but we put people up." All right, and what does it end up being? Resembling creatures, animals, four-footed beasts, creeping things, animals, human beings, odd shapes, fertility gods, animals with heads and tails like human, or tails, or whatever, horses with human heads and whatever it is. Idolaters worship the things that God made and not God himself. So this is what's important. See what Paul is doing, going back to the basics of humanity. And he's just looking at the direction humanity's gone. He said, because when they had knowledge of God, they suppressed it. And look what's happened to humanity. And he says, you know, that's God's judgment already on humanity. So the results are, verse 24, we'll make it quickly. Fortunately, there's no Packer game today. There's a lots of luck, or potluck downstairs, and we'll have something to eat. I'm sorry there. 24, God gave them up to uncleanness. 26, for this reason, God gave them up to vile affection. Verse 28, and even as they did not like to retain God in knowledge, God gave them over to debased mind. Man says, I'm going to do this. Now, one of the questions, and then we'll end this pretty quick, is this giving over active or passive? I must point this out. Is it active or is it passive? Passive, I mean, did God just step aside and say, go. This is what you choose to do, go. Well, in one sense, he did. God can't restrain every time somebody wants to do evil. He can't step in and say, whoa, you shouldn't do that. I'm going to stop it. But it's also active. It's also active. God sometimes acts in the affairs of man. It says in the Old Testament that God handed Israel's enemies over to Israel to defeat, but in other times it says God handed Israel over to their enemies for punishment. It's both active and passive. God is working. And it's active and passive. Well, what did he give them over to? I'm not going to go into these sins here. If you have Bible versions, translations, and paraphrases, I don't have to define these words in the Greek and go over them. You can see what he says, verse 24, the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves. All right. Verse 26, God gave him up to vile passions, talks about the misuse of sex, or the wrong use of sex, the perversion, or the wrong use of homosexuality. He said, man just changed it. Now, I know people come in and they'll say the same thing. Well, God doesn't think sexual matters are wrong. No, he doesn't. And there's great pleasure in sexual matters. Of course there is. You'd have to be a little out to lunch if you didn't know that. And sex is a thing God has given to the humanity. Absolutely. But there's also wrong use of it. And it becomes a strong passion until Paul said it became perverted. What is Paul doing? All he's doing is looking through human history, and he looks around him, he's saying, all of this evil, and remember, in his day, it was rampant. I read this in a history book, and I hope he's right. But 14 of 15 Roman emperors were homosexual in practice. And it was part of worship in temples. You know what's interesting? Paul wrote this letter from Corinth. And Corinth had a temple with their temple prostitutes, male and female. And it's interesting that Paul did not have a hard attitude toward them because he said, such were some of you. He believes God converts. So he wasn't saying, get rid of them, drive them out of public life. He was just simply saying in the gospel, such were some of you. And he lists these sins. But now you are washed. Now you are cleansed. Now, the gospel. See, the gospel takes you right where you're at and saves you. And you come under his love. And when you come under his love, Paul said to these Corinthians who maybe weeks before practiced this, now you're washed, now you're sanctified. Such were some of you. Well, he means they understood God's way of doing this and they did it right. So pagan practices encourage this. Verse 28, they did not retain God in his knowledge. He turned them over to debased mind. Now, I'm not going to read all of these things in verse 29, 30, and 31. But 32 I want to read. Who knowing the righteous judgment of God, who understand that a righteous God has a perfect right to judge, as laws in our country has a perfect right to convict. All right? He says in verse 28 that those who practice such things are deserving of death. Not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. Remember the lynch mobs? You saw these movies, the lynch mobs. There's some guys with the rope and they're going to lynch the guy. There's always people at the edge of the crowd. Get him, get him, get him, get him. And then they go home. Well, I didn't lynch them. Say, I wouldn't lynch anybody, but get him, hang him. That's what the lynch mob is. And what he's simply saying is that they approve of those people who practice them. Ah, let them do it. Go on, do it. Now, one of the greatest examples of that is Paul, found in Paul's life himself. When he was stoning Stephen, it says there was a young man on the edge of the crowd. His name was what? Saul. Consenting to their death, and they laid the clothes at his feet. Well, I never picked up a stone and threw it. But it says he was consenting to the death. That's what he's saying in this verse. Now, let me just wrap this up. The beans will last another minute or two. Where do we get our morality today? I prepared more, I know. Polls. Is it if it's right? If most people are doing it, it's right. Opinion polls, talk shows, telephone surveys. Now I'm making this up, but I go and I watch TV and there's on Fox News. 52.6% of the people in America say it's okay. Oh, well, wow. And then we go back and we see back in the 60s, the majority of people thought even any form of abortion was wrong. Any form of it was wrong, the majority. Now, well, that's all right, but partial birth abortion, well, we just polls, statistics, that's where we get our morality from. Or if it feels right, it's okay. In other words, if I feel wrong, I shouldn't do it. But if I feel right, I should do it. But that's emotional morality. How do you know your feelings are at a high level? How do you know you haven't been so affected by sin you can't feel anything painful? That's where conscience comes in. Or they make it up as you go along morality, what we call situational morality. The situational moral reflects anything that I want to do except personal sacrifice. That situation more. I don't know. How will this affect me? Situation. I make it up as I go along. And anything that's going to cost me something, I put aside. The morality that there are no absolutes and standards. And this is where our children are being indoctrinated in schools. I'm not going to talk about public schools against them. But there are no absolutes, no standards, no right or wrong. Only personal standards. What I feel is right. Hold your views, but don't question others or contradict others' views. That morality is killing some of our young people, robbing them of their life. So, this first part of Romans is very simple. People are guilty because God had revealed to them certain things. They suppressed it. And they demonstrated by the history of the world that sin has been rampant and God is in the process of judging. Now that's people who have no religion. Those are people who we would call the barbarians years ago. But they're guilty. And you see, the church at Rome was going to spearhead reaching Europe. As the Roman armies went out into Europe and into England, some of the earliest manuscripts of scriptures were found in simple Latin from the Roman government. We don't know how they got there. We don't know who did it, but we know this. There must have been Christians. And they were taking the gospel to these areas because they believed these people needed to know Jesus Christ because they were guilty. So Paul's letter has some effect. Father, thank you for these words. Thank you for the gospel. That the gospel shows us that you are incorruptible, holy, pure, righteous, and yet you can save people by faith, apart from our own righteousness and apart from religion. The world sometimes has been a strange place. Father, we love our intellect. We love feeling we're superior to others. And yet humanity has often lost a sense of what is true and right, because we have suppressed and held down and ignored the truth that was given. Thank you that the gospel is for the whole world, and we pray that you'll continue to send it to our neighborhood, to our neighbors, and to the other most parts of the world. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.